couldn't look back in the face after what happened last night. And under our very noses.
Mind you, identifying myself is altogether the police's fault. What I mean is they have to wink at some things. I mean, it's one thing to buy chocolates out of ours, but it's quite another to stick a knife into a gentleman. I must say I feel the same way about that, too. A good, clean, honest whack over the head with a brick is one thing. There's something British about that. But knives. No, knives is not right. I must say that's what I think and that's what I feel. Whatever the provocation, I could never use a knife. Now, mind you, a knife is a difficult thing to handle. I mean, any knife. I mean, if you use a pen knife, knife.
Alice, cut us a bit of bread, will you?
Knife. What's that of a knife? Knife. A knife is a thing. If you're careful of a knife, you come up against a knife. I mean, in Chelsea, you mustn't use a knife.
Yeah, you ought to have been more careful. Might have cut somebody with that.
Expect me to talk?
Good evening. Hello and welcome to episode 243 of Do You Expect Us to Talk? I'm Becca and as always joined by my fellow co-hosts Chris and Dave. How are you both?
Good evening, folks.
Oh, I'm feeling very good, thank you.
That's good, thank you very much. Good night.
Sorry, I was trying to think of a witty pun or joke, but just nothing came to my mind right then. So.
Well, at least you won't have to blackmail us into, you know, any dodgy dealings. But first of all,
yes, I might
have to
con
sure
you out
you
cigar.
Stand in your face, otherwise, it won't come out right, as the girl said to the soldier.
Sorry.
Did you know for tonight's film? There is a very famous sound test that Hitchcock did with his leading lady, Annie Oundra. And I kind of believe it's one of the... It's probably not, but it's one of those things that generally people seem to think that Hitch created the first That's What She Said kind of joke.
I haven't seen it, but because I needed to get through the film, but I saw that there are sound tests on YouTube. They are there.
Well, yeah, listeners, we'll post a link on our socials. But basically, the ending is like... they do the Hitch... You know, they do the sound test, and Hitchcock basically says, you know, just make sure you stand in your place, otherwise it will not come out right, as the girl said to the soldier. And it's one of those, that's what she said, you know, to the actress, to the bishop type joke.
There's a test take with two of them, and it's Hitchcock stood next to her.
Yeah, that's the one I'm on about.
That's the one? All right.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, listeners, go
check
it out. It's hilarious.
It's, yeah, if you type in, I mean, if you just type in blackmail 1929, it's the third. As of today, it's the third one. And right under it's the version of the film. So tell us about that film, Becca, and we'll get into it in a moment.
Yes, so tonight we are reviewing Blackmail, which is famously the first British talkie, starring Annie Oundra, who has also made The Manxman with Hitchcock, Cyril Richard, John Logden, Sarah Olgood, Charles Payton, Donald Calthorpe, who was also in Number 17 and Murder! Exclamation mark. So a few Hitchcock regulars from a silent era. With the score to music by Jimmy Campbell and Reginald Connolly. It's quite interesting. We'll look at the music in a moment. With the script, again from a play by Charles Bennett, which was adapted by Hitchcock himself. And also...
Although he didn't do the dialogue.
No, he didn't. The dialogue was by a chap called Ben W. Levy. But there's also an early uncredited uncredited credit. Yeah. From Michael Powell, who obviously famous for The Archers and his collaboration with Pressburger throughout films in the 40s and 50s, and whose name will pop up many times throughout this series, especially when we come to the 59-60 kind of era. And also
Ben Levy Ben Levy went on to be a Labour MP in the Clement Attlee government.
That was my fun fact. Wow, how about that?
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I'll try not to know stuff.
That's amazing. Anyway, yes, directed by Hitchcock and released in 1929.
I've only got one other fact, and Becca knows what it is, so I'll talk about that in a bit.
You take the words right out of my mouth. That's amazing.
So this is not... I'm sorry about that. I didn't know you were going to tell us.
No, not at all. That's amazing.
I just looked him up because I thought I knew the name. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm sure I don't know many backbench MPs from the 1940s, but I'd seen that name somewhere before, and that's where from. because that is the government that brought in the welfare state, the NHS, and all that stuff. So it's one of the better governments we've ever had. But anyway, the point being, this wasn't always a talkie, though, was it?
No, so two different versions of this film were made. Obviously, one in silent, and the other kind of being a talkie. But the version that is available, maybe on sort of DVD and on YouTube as well, is shot very much in the silent manner, I guess. So obviously, all the actors are kind of up to a certain point, maybe sort of 8 to 10 minutes in. Obviously, all the actors still do obviously the grandiose facial expressions and the big arm movements and things like that, as you would expect from actors in the silent era. But it's the way that
I think they've intercut it with sequences that I still think are silent. The one that really stood out to me, and we won't give away too much of the plot at this stage, but when she's in the telephone booth in her father's shop, that to me looks like it looks a bit cine and it looks a bit sort of silent expressions.
Yeah, so that's kind of like how they made this film, really. If you'll let me, I'll just there's a few points that I'll probably go through if I can. This is cribbed from other sources, so I do apologise. So obviously, from the side, during this series, we've kind of forgone most of his silent films. I've chosen to look at obviously The Lodger and Downhill, just because I think they're quite important. They obviously they contain a lot of like those Hitchcock early tropes that we'll come to in the series.
Was The Manx Man set in the Isle of Man?
Probably.
I'll look that one up in a minute.
Anyway, unfortunately, that's one that I have not seen.
All right, I'll look it up. Go on, you carry on with telling us about this.
Yeah, there's a handful of them that I have not seen, and that is one of them, unfortunately. But yeah, so basically, like, the obviously the silent films, it's kind of technically a misnomer. Obviously, no film is silent. There's going to be some kind of, like, music as well kind of involved. Blackmail is obviously famously the last of Hitchcock's silent films. Obviously, it was made during the transition from, obviously, the silent era to talkies, as they would become known. This came out in 1929. Obviously, famously, a few years before, 1927, The Jazz Singer comes out. Famous Al Jolson movie for Warner Brothers. Hugely revolutionary. They sort of realised that actually these talkies are going to become a lot more lucrative, and thus cinema was forever changed. So it was kind of, these two films are quite similar, even though these films were made two different countries, they were made in the same manner.
This was made in two different countries?
Oh my God. No, so you've got Jazz Singer and then you've got...
Should
I start that again?
No, I just thought, did they do half this film in fucking Hawaii and I missed it or something?
No, sorry. So they made Jazz Singer, obviously, is made in America, and over here, 2 years later, they made Blackmail.
Remade by, what's he called, Neil Diamond.
Yeah, remade with Neil Diamond many years later. It was shot basically without synced dialogue, and then reshot, certain scenes are reshot for the film with dialogue, as they did with Blackmail. So that's kind of why some scenes will look a bit different to others. And this is also characteristic of other films made in the late 1920s as well, made using like a phonograph and that sort of technology. So the sound would be synced kind of at the same time. And also with the music as well, obviously you see, if you go to like a silent film, for example, like at the Prince Charles Cinema, they often show like sort of The Lodger or Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, for example, and they'll have like a live score, a musician doing a live score.
Yes.
Also, if you in the 30s and 40s, if you go to a silent movie or pre-talkie movie, definitely, you'd have probably a chap come up, rise up from the middle of, you know, before the stage on a Wurlitzer or something like that, on a big organ sort of playing the score. So obviously the musical scores run the entire length of the film in the silent era.
That's still in this film to a degree, isn't it?
Yeah, we do still have that quite a little bit as well. It's obviously different today, and it transforms the way that scores would be written overall.
Well, I have to just quickly say that the difference in the two versions is there is a difference of length. I think the silent one is something like 76 minutes and this is like 85.
Yeah.
I had to look that up because 6-7 minutes into the film, I didn't know if I was watching the sound version. And I thought, as we're talking about the first British talkie, I really did need to watch the one with dialogue in it. But it does turn out, yeah, if you're watching an 85-minute version of the film, you're watching the talkie. I was watching a colourised one as well.
Yeah, there is a colourised one on YouTube, and I haven't seen that one, but I'll check it out after this one. But it seems interesting.
I wouldn't normally do that. I'd normally go for the way it was released in the first place. The reason I went with the colourised one is you'll have heard, listeners, at the start of this episode, our first clip, because obviously I can't use a clip from a silent film. There isn't any clip to use. So I did our intro sting and then, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents music. I think I'll still be using that for a while because I couldn't find discrete little bits of music from this that were satisfying. But I did find a clip. And it was from,
you can maybe use a clip from, there's that song that he plays, Miss Up to Date. But again, I don't know, you might be slapped with copyright or it might be on public domain. I don't know.
But whatever it is, obviously, as we get deeper into Hitchcock, I'll have proper, you know, good dialogue sequences from famous films with famous Bernard Herrmann scores and things like that.
But yeah, we're running into the big ones. We're getting into the big league soon.
Sounded bad. And I started watching the black and white version, which I have had stored in my sort of YouTube. Well, it's the account for our podcast, actually. I've got the, so where you go to watch ours, I've got some watch later things from Hitchcock in there. And I had one stored and started watching it. It was black and white and the sound quality and picture quality were just not good enough. So I had a look and I was actually looking for clips because I was still doing that bit. And I happened across the colorized one and thought, I wonder if it sounds and looks better. And it did. So that's why I watched it.
I'll check that one out.
It's a really strange juxtaposition because you're watching what in stylistic terms is sort of still a silent film in a lot of ways and in a lot of places, but you're watching it in colour that doesn't look altogether terrible. So it makes it look a strange anomaly of the era. But yeah,
coloration, it's interesting because, I mean, we could probably do a podcast on its own, but I mean, like, for example, for the Doctor Who 60th anniversary, they colorized the Daleks, one of the early 60s William Hartnell episodes,
which looked very strange, but it was done
in a really faithful way. And likewise, you'll see clips of, like, for example, somebody has colorized the shower scene in Psycho, for example, which, sacrilege. But but it's really interesting as an experiment. And also, there's a few sort of Twitter X accounts that will colorize, you know, classic Doctor Who black and white images or any images of it from, you know, behind the scenes of Bond films that were shot in black and white. They'll sort of colorize those photos, like stills photos, things like that. And I'm just going to carry on with my points just to get them out of the way, and then listeners can have enough of me waffling on. What else? Oh yeah, so yeah, another benefit or not of, you know, sort of sound versus silent era as well. If you notice, especially while watching this film, some of the actors do look a bit distracted, like they'll look off to one side or they'll wander around to one side. Especially, you know, not just Hitchcock's films, but generally films of, like, sort of the late 1920s as well. It's obviously because, you know, the director was shouting directions at them, for example. Whereas obviously with sound, you kind of do have to be a bit careful with that one. But you might have, you know, carpenters or whatever doing work in the next room. Whereas obviously with sound, you kind of, you know, it does cause massive problems. So you kind of have to really be careful of that.
Recent film Babylon
any film about filmmaking. So Babylon is quite a good example.
Shows you how they struggled with the sounds, but also how some of the stars didn't have the right voice to become stars when talkies came in.
No, exactly, which leads me nicely on to my second point. Obviously, it's Hitchcock's second collaboration with Annie Andre, the first one being The Manxman. I think she was Czech, Eastern European, so she had quite a strong accent.
Yeah.
So if you listen...
She lived in Germany, but yeah.
Yeah, she lived in Germany most of her life, but she was Czech origin for sure. But yeah, listeners, if you do check out, literally just go onto YouTube and Google Hitchcock blackmail sound test. It's quite famous. It includes a really good example of Hitchcock's quite cheeky / blue sense of humour. Famously, Annie Oldham had an accent, whereas kind of back in the day, I mean, today it wouldn't really be a problem, but I think back in the day, especially to British audiences as well, they perhaps might not be able to understand or know what was going on, so they would just get up and leave, because it was in that era again that Hitch pioneered of where you could just, they would just show a film and you come and go as you please, pretty much. But yeah, Annie Andre, she had a really strong Czech Eastern European accent. She was dubbed by Joan, not John Barry, who actually stood next to the camera, but kind of like behind the camera. And so while Andra basically mouthed her lines, they'd be spoken in real time by Barry. So it wasn't synced up afterwards in post. There wasn't no such thing as post back then, but performed live. And so obviously, yeah, we mentioned earlier about some sort of scenes looking a bit different in this film as well. So the first kind of like talkie, in the talkie version of this film, the first shot with dialogue is probably occurs about 8 or 10 minutes into the film. And there's two policemen in their hats and coats, so they look a bit identical. It's shot from behind, they're walking away from the camera with their backs to us.
Yeah.
So obviously we don't see their lips move, but you hear about a line of dialogue. Which is very cleverly done, and it's a good way to introduce it to the film. Also, you mentioned obviously Babylon, a big, it shows how sort of, you know, how the introduction of sound really affected the filmmaking process. Silent films were produced very quickly, one after the other, often multiple films a day, and actors would kind of go from one production to the next. With an introduction of sound, this kind of really slowed everything down, both in terms of film production.
Again, Babylon shows you this. Loads of films filming right
it does.
Next to each other.
Yeah, literally just all in one go, and then you kind of go from bang, 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 one to the other. And especially with the direction of sound as well, where kind of you know, got to be so careful. And it was also where, like, when those early sound films as well, you don't see much fluidity of the camera because of, you know, cameras were very much housed in kind of soundproof booths, which perhaps weren't very mobile. And it wasn't until, I can't remember now, certain the invention of certain technologies came along that really helped kind of muffle that a little bit and kind of were built into the camera to make it a bit more fluid. So yeah, and especially in terms of the expense as well. So the most expense spared was in casting the voice actors. So again, that was something else that was added to, you know, another great innovation. But it was something else that slowed production down because it got more expensive. Also, as we know, Hitchcock loved point of view. That's another one we come to see more. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Psycho, which is why I wanted to do this series. But there was a lot of that film in this film. I didn't realise how much until I watched it probably like the third or fourth time, and I was like, oh, okay, so there's quite a lot of that. And it's quite unique in that way that it shows you it from the women's point of view as well. And obviously, Alma Revel had uncredited input on writing the script as well. So it was quite unique. It was from the female perspective. It's largely from Alice's perspective. And a lot of shots as well that you'll see, like, from a character's perspective, like the landlady, for example, and you'll hear dialogue spoken again off screen. So it's trying to work it into the film in a really sort of technically clever way that doesn't involve, you know, it probably saved Hitchcock a few bob. And it's also, like, subject matter is quite dark as well. It's the first sort of, obviously, this is very pre-code. Postcode probably wouldn't come until 34. But it shows something's quite dark, and it shows, you know, obviously Hitchcock's films are kind of known for being quite murky and quite sort of quite violent. Some, you know, sort of like really dark and dangerous subject matter is a subject that he would be quite known well for. It depicts sexual assault, trigger warning, shown from the point of view of Alice. And it kind of, you know, does a typical thing of shining lights on kind of unsavory aspects of society, like sort of wealthy people and how sort of like dodgy they are and how kind of unsavory they are generally. Again, lots in common in Psycho as well. And my final point, thank you for listening to me. My final point, obviously there's a big car chase, a 1920s car chase at the end of this film. The action of this was sped up, it was shot from a high frame rate. It makes it kind of more exciting as well. And there's kind of a bookending almost going on as well. So you've kind of got the film opens with like this image of like a spinning wheel or tire going around almost. And then that's obviously concluded at the end with the car chase, 1920s car chase. So I think that's, you know, it's kind of like another trope. But that's just a few points that I want to draw your attention to in the film. So yeah, thank you very much for listening to me.
So the thing is, I kept misreading her name. I wondered why Andre Onana from the Manchester United goalkeeper was in the film. just a quick aside, I did look up the Manx Man. They began filming it on the Isle of Man, but then relocated it to Polperro in Cornwall.
Oh, nice.
Which is 12 miles away from me.
That's not too far from you, Dave.
No, 12 miles away. But yeah, it's a strange film in that I still feel that it felt like a Hitchcock film to me, in a lot of ways, and I'm sure you'll be better at pulling those things out than maybe I am. But I could see it was like, you know, in the same sort of canon, although a lot more primitive. The things that are particularly primitive of it outside of the technology is, I mean, and they have, yeah, they've had to overdub certain things. So you've got people talking, walking away from cameras, which just does not look right at all. But I would have thought, leave those scenes, you know what I mean? But there you go. But I also think that maybe they could have done a hybrid with more sort of interstitial sort of bits. I don't know. Maybe they could have done a bit of both.
Intertitles, do you mean?
Yeah. But I think intertitles, I said, yeah. I was mixing up about four different words in my head then.
But, you know what you mean. Sorry, yeah. It's like me not pronouncing a word, sorry.
No, I don't even know what word I was going for, but there you go. But the intertitles, yeah, they could have mixed that up a little bit. What I will say is the pacing of this film is really sort of birth of cinema still. It's still all over the shop. I mean,
yeah.
The crime in question doesn't happen until 34 minutes into an 85-minute
film.
Yeah,
for a book called Blackmail, there isn't a lot of blackmail in it. It happens
The blackmail in question is one elongated scene in a shop, really.
It really is, but it contains one hell of a match.
It's more like teased blackmail, isn't it? It's more like,
this could get nasty for you over time. Oh, I was only joking, old boy. But
I use some money, but that's it.
we'll get to all of that. So I did think the pacing was bad. You can tell we're at the early days of dialogue because the way the coppers talk to each other in that early scene is just the most perfunctory dialogue you can ever imagine coming out with.
It's a bit cringe, isn't it?
And also, it finishes like an episode of Thundercats. Every episode of Thundercats used to finish on something like "the joke's on you, Snarf," and then they were all robotically laughing until they went to credits.
And that's exactly what I compliment Dave on his really good liner impression.
Sorry? Do you think that was pretty, was it?
Yeah, I think that's pretty spot on, I think.
What I also found ridiculous was with things like Thundercats is you'd watch something like Tom and Jerry from 30 or 40 years before that even came about, and it's and it's flawlessly animated, and then you watch Thundercats and it's robotic as fuck.
Yeah,
I was never particularly a fan, actually, but I did catch the end of a lot of episodes because maybe they were going to something else I wanted to watch afterwards.
Is that the original show you watched, Dave, or
in the 80s? Yeah.
And I loved that show growing up. That was one of my favourite things. Oh my god, like that. Obviously, Jerry Hunter repeat in the 90s, like Ninja Turtles, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, see, I was a Masters of the Universe guy. I remember the first episode of Masters of the Universe airing in this country. It was introduced by Matthew Kelly.
Oh.
Because they had guest presenters on Children's ITV or whatever it was.
I don't remember that. Wow.
And he did a month. Yeah, but it would have been 83, 84.
So I would have been not born yet.
Yeah, so I watched a load of that, but yeah, I didn't really like. But every episode ended up with a lame joke and them all laughing ridiculously.
It does kind of end a little bit like that. Like, obviously, I've got a fun, well, not really fun fact, but I've got a fact towards the end about why it ends the way it does. And if you go onto a really good website, it's tvtropes.org as well, and one of the tropes is kind of like they all laugh at the end, basically. But it's also been parodied in. Naked Gun, which is a parody of.
It's Police Squad, actually.
Police Squad, that was it, thank you.
They would freeze frame at the end, but they're not frozen, so things would still be happening. Like, one of them, he's holding a cup and the guy's pouring a coffee, and it's really starting to burn his hand. But you saw it in Austin Powers where they laugh and then sort of run out of
energy. Yeah, it's literally like that. I guess that's kind of where it all comes from. It can all be traced back to this film, perhaps.
The dialogue is terrible there as well, and it's really, really dated, the dialogue, because it's all women police officers and, you know, sort of thing. But,
it was 1929, you know. I mean, to be fair, like, obviously, Hitchcock would probably be cancelled by now. Obviously, you know, every single one of his films is not going to be perfect. There's probably, you know, obviously, like, sort of Vertigo, Psycho.
Nearly a century ago, folks.
That sort of thing, literally. I mean, there's a few that, you know, North by Northwest, are going to be some absolute stone cold, hands down classics. Not everyone's going to be great. And likewise, I've decided not to, you know, some of these films are just purely because I'm interested in it, also because they will have big commercial appeal. So that's why I've chopped out a lot of the silent era. And just gone
it's a historic hybrid, isn't it?
It was, anything that's like historically a landmark. I mean, when we come to Psycho, obviously, would have, because it was one of the first slasher movies, so it has that cultural significance as well. And likewise, obviously, North by Northwest, because it was arguably Bond before Bond. But again, we can debate that when we get there, so it's got that significance to it. And obviously, we're now coming into the next. Obviously, we're going into kind of like more of his well-known kind of era now, and going into kind of like almost the war, pre-war, post-war kind of era.
Oh, we're about to have a massive uptick in quality, aren't we?
Yes, we are, precisely. We'll get there when we come to it. But basically, not every film's going to be perfect. I mean, personally, I would probably prefer this film over like some of his other, you know, sort of like Juno and the Peacock and Manxman, things like that, for example, which I need to see. But I think for me, probably, it's not going to be perfect. So, I mean, it's one of my favourites, but even though, you know, it's going to be sort of culturally significant, it's still quite interesting to look at it from that angle, even if it is terrible. But it is, as you say, Dave, it is pretty much like dawn of cinema, definitely. You can see a lot of these things coming through.
I'm not sure I think it's terrible, because there's still signs of talent here.
Well, there are, definitely.
But you have, basically, an industry full of silent movie actors now having to do voices. And suddenly they're having to write dialogue, whereas they just had to write, and we joked about the word before, but the word was correct. They had to write scenarios before. And if characters appear
That's
to
why a lot of
talk to
these films did
themselves.
come from, like, from plays or, you know, other mediums, for example, because it had, you know, it was kind of predetermined almost. But yeah, just go and check out, you know, this film's not gonna be perfect.
But it's I
I mean,
didn't
there
hate
are some
it.
aspects of this film definitely which you can see, like, there are aspects of it which, you know, you'll see later on in Frenzy, for example, or you'll see it's sort of later films, and there are kind of threads. I would, when we did The Lodger, obviously that kind of gets touted as, like, the Hitchcock film, as it were. I would kind of argue that perhaps this might be. There's a lot of more, obviously, in as many tropes that you'll see later in his films, but I think this kind of really cements it. So it's kind of like saying Goldfinger is, like, the first, you know, Bond, fully formed Bond film, for example. And then other people kind of argue, oh wait, no, that's probably Thunderball, for example. But I would kind of argue there's probably more tropes in this than there are in than compared to The Lodger, for example. But it's just, you know, difference of opinion. But yeah, anyway, sorry,
I
carry
was
on.
trying to think. No, I was just trying to think if this was silent as well, the same plot but completely silent, and they got it all across to us in the intertitles and so on. Where would I be placing it amongst the other two? And I still think that this is we got a bit of a flavour of Hitchcock in that first one, and then we sort of got a step further removed from it last time out. Here I'm seeing Hitchcock again, but it's not quite as atmospheric as the first film.
No, not quite
And
as fully formed.
this is a film. I know this sounds silly because, of course, the man is still 29 at this point when this film comes out. But I do think, you know, I'd like to have seen
29
Hitchcock.
still looking like he's in his 58.
Yeah, the only thing is, in the test take, you do see him his hair, but he's wearing a hat in the film, and we'll get to that. And it just looks like Alfred Hitchcock as you know him, and he's in his 20s. I don't think he ever gained or lost any weight. He just always looks the same.
I
But
think it did kind of fluctuate a little bit up and down,
did it?
but obviously, yeah, he's generally quite portly gentleman as we know him.
But I mean that's it for me. We can talk through the details. The devil will be in the details, but at the outset, I say what I've said the previous 2 weeks. This is a very immature art form at this point, and now they're throwing in sound. And no one's ever written dialogue before. No one's ever had to perform dialogue. No one's, you know, and no one's really thought about it. And again, we've got a dubbed actress here because, and as I say, it did make me think of Babylon in quite a few places because you
It was
had
that
like
era, wasn't it?
actors going to sound, and suddenly the magic's gone because their voice isn't right or whatever. And then you do have one sequence which is quite comedic with Margot Robbie trying to film the first scene, which she can't get her mark right. It's too hot in there. The machine capturing the sound is like burning.
And then the cameraman dies.
And then the
And the
cameraman
cameraman dies,
dies
yeah.
because they won't let him get out of the booth. He's stuck in and sweating.
He's trapped and he melts.
It's really worth seeing that film, but
Yeah.
the only other thing that
They
made me
probably had a
think of
wild
that film
party.
is this is relatively daring because again we're still a year pre-Hays Code, so you do have a stripping down. Although you don't see anything, it would have been quite racy for its era.
Yeah, just the fact
There
that she gets
is,
down to her negligee is quite shocking. Yeah, considering it's pre-code.
and you know there's a clearly attempted rape in this,
Yeah, unfortunately.
I
mean,
The
to be fair,
bad guy
he
doesn't. I
does get
don't.
killed for it, so.
But the bad guy in this, or the first, I suppose he was the bad guy, but the criminal doesn't get their comeuppance here,
No, another
even though
shocking
it's in
ending.
self-defense. So there's a lot to be said about it. But that'll do for me for a minute. What did you make of it, Chris?
Yeah, kind of the same. I think, you know, parts of it did kind of drag for me.
Its pacing is awful, isn't it?
Yeah, just but I think again, as part of that is my sensibilities. You know, it is an earlier film. I haven't got my, my ears, and I'm tuned into it right properly. But then, as you said before, this is a rarely new medium in its infancy. It's still trying to find its feet, so it's hard to kind of, we say this like, oh, its pacing's bad, but is it, would you be really that hard against like someone like new coming up? Or anyone doing something sort of that's relatively new. So yeah, I think it's just one of the things. It is what it is. It's like an early art form that's not quite found its feet. So but apart from that, yeah, it is a pretty straightforward, simple story.
It's an easy watch, although, yeah, when I say easy watch, this isn't meant as a pun, but I was checking mine a few times just because I was noticing the pacing and I was thinking, right, and when the murder happens, I call it up and it's like 34 minutes. And then, like, the blackmail doesn't happen for a little while and it's like this is all over the shop. But again, I tend to go easy on it. Mm. What I can say to be positive is I am starting to see the filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock will become, but he's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
Becca?
Yeah, our next film, he will be fully formed. Because we'll skip ahead a few.
We'll skip ahead to Vertigo.
We'll skip ahead to the end.
Family plot. Yeah, that's it. Family plot.
He'll be dead. Oh, well.
Family Flop is his last film from 1976.
His last gasp.
But what do you think of it in general, Becca? Or what do you...
What Family Plot? We haven't got there yet.
No, this one.
Oh, this one. Yeah, it's not without its problems. I think there's definitely lots. As you say, the medium is kind of very much kind of in its infancy. Kind of sound is very new, relatively adopted. And obviously the acting is still quite stilted. There's the scenes where that have been recorded with sound are kind of inserted in, and it's quite noticeable what is silent and what's not. But there are some clever ways that Hitch kind of works around it. He's still very much, you know, forming his craft. There's still quite a lot of, for example, it's very much expressionistic references as well. So you kind of see those kind of German references coming in, especially for light and shadow as well. Like there's a scene early on with the two detectives in profile, and the way kind of like the light is kind of I was going to use a word which sounded quite rude, but I won't say that now. The way the light falls across their face is almost
comes
kind of,
on just, their face. You were going to say
I was going to say shafted.
Shafted on their face. That's even more violent.
Sorry about that. I'm having a bit of a night tonight. I do apologise. Yeah, the way the light falls on the face almost anticipates noir, maybe 10, 20 years or so before. It could be out of a kind of like a, you know,
it's split the difference, can't you? The big noir era was the 40s, really, or it's probably more like 50,
And that kind of era. And also, likewise, there's a scene where light and shadow is used with the villain, with Crew. And it's kind of like from the silhouette of like a chandelier that's hanging above his head. It kind of looks like he's got like a villainous moustache that he could almost be twirling. And likewise, there's a scene towards the end, spoiler alert for this really old film, everybody. Obviously, a scene towards the end where it looks like she's, I think it's just before she writes the confession letter. And it's kind of made to look like as if, you know, there's kind of a shadow kind of falls across her neck. So it looks like she's in the noose, unfortunately, because she would probably come. So there's still quite clever techniques like that done as well, and obviously there's quite a few tropes that we see in this film which we'll go through as we go along. But yeah, I mean, the acting, the performance and the dialogue is a little bit stilted. It's not great, not kind of fully formed, but it's getting there. And likewise, there are some camera movements which do look a bit dodgy, as I would say. There's a scene very early on, there's a camera, the camera kind of zooms in to look at reflection in a mirror, and it's quite a, you can kind of feel it moving. It's not done in a very kind of smooth, fluid way. But again, kind of, you know, technology is very much kind of in its infancy for sure. So you can forgive that almost a little bit. I'll say you can kind of see a lot of these things trying to come together, and they're perhaps not yet fully formed just yet. But we'll get there. But Annie Andrew is great. I mean, for the most part, the performances are brilliant. The villain's kind of quite slimy. He's appeared with Hitchcock in a few of his previous films before. I think that
he does come across as a proper scumbag, doesn't he? As soon as he's come
he really
to
does, it. Yeah. It's like dodgy type. Not to typecast somebody, but he probably popped up in a villain in quite a few of these films. Andre's great. Crew is suitably slimy as the villain. He doesn't really take no for an answer, so he deserves what he gets. Who else? I can't remember her name, but she's the nosy neighbour who says knife about 10 times.
Yes, she's like a customer in the stop. That's a well done scene, actually. It is the clip on. I've not got an abundance of clips to choose from, so it's not a great sounding clip, but it's the one on the start of this episode. And what it is we'll explain when we get to it. But it's her perception, so it sounds odd, but we'll explain.
Yeah, she tunes in and out of the conversation, and I counted. I think it's 10 times that she says it. I had to count when I watched it this morning. I thought, wait, how many times does she say it? And she kind of drifts in and out, and that's something. And there's another kind of nice shot where what's her name? Alice. Where Alice looks out of a window instead of seeing and sees like a advert over, you know, in across the way, and it goes from being whatever the advert is, like a cocktail shaker, to like a knife being kind of stepped up and down, sort of thing. So there's lots of really kind of like visual cues like that, for example. Yeah, good performances. Quite like the music. Miss Up to Date is quite a good song. Quite relevant today, actually, even though it was written in the late 1920s, it's still relevant today. And that's performed live then, you know, in the film, by Crute, which is quite interesting, I think, because he was an artist and musician in real life. Yeah, so aspects of the score still a bit dodgy. I mean, the car chase is a bit lacking in pace, and it's very 1920s. But again, also, you kind of got that big the rooftop kind of chase, and sort of Hitchcock trope of monumental chase as well, which we'll see, like Vertigo and famously
Man Who Knew Too Much.
North by Northwest as well, for example, we'll see it in. So it's another one of those things. So it's a really, for me, it's a really mixed bag. I don't have much trouble with pacing as you guys did. But again, it is, it's a silent movie. It's quite slow. We haven't just kind of really got there just yet. Yeah, so it's a real mixed bag for me, but I still think it's a classic. Andra's fantastic, definitely. And because I didn't realise that her dialogue was kind of not dubbed as such after the fact, but kind of done live, and I sort of learnt about that and was like, wow, you know, from a technical point of view, that was incredible. I never knew that, and I couldn't really tell. So that really impressed me, because I'm easily impressed. But yeah, it's probably a mixed bag. 3 out of 5. But no, still hugely enjoyable. But, you know, I'm just glad to get through this era and then move on to Hitchcock as we come to know him.
It was amazing how unchained the British Museum and the area around it, it seems to be. So I used to, the organisation I used to work for had a head office in Lincoln's Inn Fields, which is a short walk down the road from there. And we used to stay in hotels around there. And there was a pub literally opposite it that I've been in a few times, and it's instantly recognisable.
It's probably still there.
Although their geography of London is quite funny, but we'll get to that. And I'm not an expert on London. I've been there for a long time.
There's a shot where they go to Trafalgar Square as well, don't they? And you can kind of, there is that. I mean, you can still get it. You can still access that route today.
Shall we discuss this film sequentially?
Let's do it.
Right. Okay. So.
Sorry, Chris. I feel like you're getting a word in edgeways.
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
Again, we're talking about pacing. We start with a completely unrelated crime just to show some idea of what policemen do. and I do say policemen because they are all men.
And I think this is kind of like part of where it drags a bit, because you just see, it seems like about 10 minutes or so. It looks like lots of like archive footage of policemen doing stuff, and you're like, kind of like, right,
and we need to see every stage of it as well. We see everything to do with the day they go and arrest this guy. And I tried really hard to read what the crime was. The first word was something like theft or stealing of.
Blackmailing.
But I don't actually know, because you read plot synopsis where it refers to a rape or something like that. And that's not supported by what I saw. But it was a crime on a woman from an older guy that they come in to arrest. And you just see what the two policemen do. They are told their special branch. I don't know what I thought special branch always did with dealt with like domestic terrorism and things like that. But anyway. Maybe I'm thinking of the flying squad. I don't know. I'll go to the special branch now. But they go and arrest this guy, and then we see them talk to him over several cigarettes.
Yes, that's quite a good passage of time. I think that's quite interesting. We'll see that when we come to do Notorious, hopefully, if I can wangle it in. That'll be shown again with these really, Hitchcock uses a really good motif, but with champagne bottles, and it's almost in reverse.
Yeah, special branch was what I said it was. It is to do with intelligence and national security and stuff. I don't know if we still have one, because I know certain things have been disbanded over the years. But yeah, so they arrest this guy. A woman comes in, identifies him in a lineup. We then see, after he's been talk to. We then see him fingerprinted, go to the cells, and it's just really long-winded, but it's just Frank's working day, Detective Frank Webber.
Detective Frank on the job.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's got something, because obviously, you know the famous story, obviously in any of these sort of films, the police are kind of always idiots, or they don't, I mean here obviously they kind of, they do a lot of subversion, and they kind of, they do eventually get their man, but generally in these sort of films, the police are always a step behind, they were kind of...
Are you suggesting they're trying to paint competency?
Well, this is I think this is probably one of those few films where, like, obviously the police do kind of, obviously he finds that the glove sort of presents it to her, but then he decides to, you know, put it all under the carpet and try and pin everything on Tracy, who I want to call Jeff, but that's not his name. But I wonder if it's got something to do with, obviously, you know, that story about Hitchcock, for example, that kind of famously instilled that kind of fear in the police, where, like, apparently when he was a young boy, his father sent him along to a police station with a note saying, oh, this is what happens to naughty boys. And they kind of basically threw him in a cell for, you know, overnight or something like that, or for a few hours. But whether or not that's true, we don't know.
Because when Hitchcock talks about it, he says, I actually don't remember it, but...
Well, that's it, yeah. So it may not be true. It may be an urban myth, I don't know. But generally in his films, the kind of police are generally always on the back foot, or they're seen as quite threatening presence in his films. So they, you know, they rarely do get their man. So perhaps this is probably an early example of that, for example. I mean, like, you know, when we saw in The Lodger, the copper, he was an idiot, idiot boyfriend. And again, it's another example of that. And it's something that we'll see as, you know, something as we'll see as we go through, like a Psycho, for example, like the policeman, the highway patrolman, is quite a threatening, quite a dangerous figure, looming large, his face taking up the whole screen, burying into your soul. So, you know, just as an example of that, really. So I kind of wonder where that sort of really comes to, and that's kind of the seed of that is kind of really sown here, perhaps. I don't know. That's my theory, anyway.
Okay. I mean, it could be that, but it isn't.
It's probably not.
It's not the greatest way to start this film, because what comes next, of course, is you get the first bits of sound where they say, are we ready to go out?
Yeah.
You know, really, really basic stuff.
Really enunciated.
I mean, the funny thing is, there's lots of this film that doesn't have a lot of dialogue. But where it does have dialogue, they feel the need to say everything, because they're not used to, like, exposition and getting plot points. They could have just gone straight out. In a modern film, they wouldn't
really
say that to each other.
You would have just seen them, like, out.
Yeah, exactly. You don't need it at all. But it's like, hey, we've got this sound. People will love to hear them talk about that. And I imagine for the first people to see this were impressed, although... This film, when it was sort of ranked in films of the year by various things, it was coming out to a public that largely watched the silent version, because obviously cinemas weren't fitted to this. But it did get some sort of awards at the end of the year and so on. Although I read up and it said its gross was $160. That's got to be a typo. I can't imagine it.
That's quite cheap.
Really?
Wasn't it kind of one of the highest rated or the highest grossing films of the time? Well, was it any British films? I can't.
Yes, for America, it was.
Of the day, so British films were its time.
I mean, I saw that on IMDb, which is an American site, so perhaps it didn't do anything there. I don't know.
Adjusted for inflation.
Adjusted for inflation, if it was 160 quid, that's a worry, because that means it's about 15 people saw it. Of course, again, I don't want to beat this film up too badly, because I think it hangs together quite well. But we've just had this, which feels like a whole waste of time when we never see this guy
chop,
again.
Chop out the beginning for sure.
They go out. He meets Alice, who I believe is like his girlfriend. They're certainly dating anyway. And she's an absolute fucking misspot. He is an idiot in this sequence. And later on, when he is trying to sort of protect her and look after her, she's completely recategorized as a person. Like, the incident has instantly made her grow up.
She's, like, really fickle, isn't she? And then she's like, oh, no, I want to do this or no, I want to do that. But
she's met him there, arranged a date with somebody else just in case, refuses to do anything he wants to do, then changes the mind to say, yes, we will do that, and then changes her mind once more.
Maybe she's missed up to date. That's what it is. All these dirty stop-outs.
She doesn't come off well in this.
Yeah, she does. She just comes across as really irritating. Like, kind of like...
You
see him getting, like, really frustrated. And you kind of half thinking, like, oh, sod this, I'm off. Like, you're surprised he doesn't leave sooner. Really.
He puts up with it for quite a while. And nothing he can do is right. And she's just entitled, spoiled, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of that doesn't ring true with the rest of the film. You know,
no.
in that she is the daughter, we find, of a couple that run like a tobacco shop, for want of a better
term. Yeah, he's a tobacco shop.
Yeah, it's just, it's a local small business. The chances are she's been working in that shop since she was a child. She's probably been quite well brought up. And so
would you say they're middle class?
I don't have enough context for the time in terms of how easy it was for people to start businesses. But I mean, it's analogous to somebody having a corner shop now, isn't it?
Yep.
The only thing is, he probably does have some quite expensive imported stuff there.
Cigars.
Yeah. It literally is just a specialist
and,
sort
and
of
a
tobacco
big house and probably in the centre of London.
Well, this is it. She's quite kind of well-to-do. I guess, because it's another trope of the film, basically, where generally kind of posh people or people that are wealthy are also quite, there's something quite seedy going on underneath, and there's something we'll come to, or quite unsavory.
I mean, we do know that in generations gone by, people had like council houses in like Chelsea are now worth fucking well over £1 million.
Yeah.
So I don't know if London then was London now. It was probably a bit more expensive than the rest of the country, but I don't know if the difference is what it is now, because it's got people from around the world putting pressure on that price.
I'm not sure what the class system really would be back then. I wouldn't describe them as posh, put it that way.
They're definitely not. They're definitely not. They're fairly humble, hard-working people.
But just like, they'd probably be like sort of your average.
I think
kind of
he's
like
probably got to be middle class just because of his job.
Yeah.
Well, the film wouldn't be substantially different if, say, he was a tailor or something.
No, that's it.
It doesn't really matter, but
he's got that kind of like high sort of social standing because he is a figure of the law.
But her first scene in the film
does not match
the woman who's in the rest of the film at all.
No, but yeah, she's annoying. She's
And I've got to choose my words carefully here, because I'm not suggesting she in any way deserves what happens to her.
No, of course not.
But it's not the most sympathetic way to set it up. She's just left a decent, hardworking man who's trying to do everything. Who's done everything to try and please her, and headed off with a clearly leering fella who is instantly trying to get in her pants.
And doesn't take no for an answer.
And I'm just thinking, well, like, if you were trying to build our sympathy towards her, this is not the best way to do it.
I think what he kind of does, I think she does give a really good performance, but it's obviously the first half of the film is completely different, as you say, to the second half of the film. After she gets him behind the curtain, there's kind of a lot of scenes where she's very tormented, she's very kind of in turmoil over it.
So she meets this guy, what's he called?
Crew?
I forget.
Cruise.
Okay, Mr. Crew, that's it. So she heads off with him. He's an artist who lives in some kind of a room or a suite of rooms in a house, because there's a landlady downstairs. It's hilarious when you read the Wikipedia description of the plot. They describe her as the concierge. It's she's not really the concierge. She's the fucking landlady in a house, and a middle-aged one at that. But anyway,
she's a great character. I think the female characters, maybe with the exception of Annie Andre,
the main one,
they're all great in this film.
They really are, actually. What made me smile about this, though, was as they get outside his house, she says, "Oh, well, we're neighbours. I live just round the corner in the my parents are tobacconists," or whatever she describes them as. And then she goes in. He's showing her his art and he wants to paint her and all the rest of it. And it's just a ruse to get her into another dress, try it on with her, not try the dress on, try sex on with her. And then sort of make her unable to sort of get back into her old clothes. And he basically goes to then grab her and rape her. She then walks around the corner to her shop, and it seems to be a several hour walk through central London.
Yeah, it's a really busy street. She's walking like almost in a daze on this really busy street, and it's literally just next door. So it's like, very strange.
Anyway, but yeah, so she grabs a knife as he's obviously been cutting some bread or whatever, and she grabs that knife as he was trying to rape her quite clearly, and she then sort of emerges with a bloodied knife in her hand.
I would say that scene is actually quite bloodless, because she doesn't have any on her clothes or hands or anything like that.
No, there is some on the knife though.
A little bit, a little speck.
I never saw one, but I could be hearing right.
It's, obviously, it's in contrast later on, but you know, especially because it happens behind a curtain, sort of thing. Yeah, for a scene, that kind of thing, it's not very bloody at all. I'd say maybe like a little bit. But I was that's also kind of have to suspend your disbelief a little bit because you'd probably come out a bit more dirty in that scene.
She should be covered in it.
She should, but she's not.
If she'd had some kind of coat she puts over the top and hides the clothes later, no, I don't know. But they didn't deal with that. So she goes on a several hour walk through London. And there's some nice little Hitchcock touches here. I think they're pretty Hitchcock touches. She looks up and she sees like a not neon but yeah a lit up display
neon sign.
Of like a cocktail being shaken, obviously like a cocktail and in her head it just changes to a knife being plunged, and that's a nice little effect. Every time she sees someone's hand reach out, she pictures the hand of the dead guy being reached out.
Again, that's a bit of a trope, isn't it, sort of a dead hand.
So she's tormented all the way home, goes straight to bed. And her mum walks right in and goes, right, it's not like you've not been asleep all night. Cracking dialogue. Where did we go from there? What's next?
She goes down and has breakfast. She picks up like basically like the same kind of knife to cut the bread.
And it is the same knife. It was beside bread in the first place as well. Yeah. So it's the same scenario pretty much. Yeah. Okay,
and
so...
she flips out and frightened like, oh, yeah.
Well, they've got like a breakfast room that goes off the body of the main body of the shop. And so you've got customers and people from the area who maybe aren't buying anything and just pop in and chat to them every day. And there's some
quite a free for all, doesn't it? But a strange
arrangement. There's a frosty middle-aged woman who's talking to them whilst breakfast is about to be served.
Yeah, so, I feel like I'll put a bug off. We're going to have breakfast.
Simpler times where, you know, we had communities. Lovely.
Well, it is, Chris. I think you're right, actually. I think you fit the nail on the head there. I think that's what it's all about. You know, people would come in because they probably wouldn't see each other for days. And this was, obviously, there's a telephone, but it was the days before, like, you know, everybody did have a telephone or...
Most people didn't.
Things like that. This is it. And, you know, the fact that they did have a phone in their shop would probably have been, like, a main focal point for the community. So, yeah, I think you're 100% right, Chris.
And I don't know what I don't know how phones were charged for in this era, because the policeman comes in at one point, the boyfriend, and says, I came in to use your phone. And it's like, well, help yourself, mate. So perhaps there wasn't a charge. I don't know.
On a system.
But so, she freaks out. And that is the thing we were talking about earlier. This woman they've just heard about this death. Okay. They've just found the body. And this woman is going on, I couldn't use a knife on someone. And that word knife, to start...
Yeah, it's repeated like 10 times.
You hear it in context of what she's saying, but then that drops out to like a little babble with the word knife being like...
Yeah, every so often.
Stressed, and then really loud the last time.
Yeah, that's really weird, isn't it? It's very strange.
It's a bit like Homer Simpson trying to concentrate on something. And there was a scene in Frasier as well from the perspective of the dog. And all he could pick out was his own name.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like that. And so she flips out over that. And then I think to the same time, Frank is assigned as one of the policemen on the case. Mm. And they go there to sort of look at the building. And they actually say to him, can you just have a look around? They're with the body. I'm presuming one is the sort of senior detective and the other one's probably a doctor.
Because yeah, he's like a coroner or something.
Because you hear him say there is evidence of a struggle.
Yeah, like jugular and things like that.
But again, he doesn't say it in that. He says something like there was a fight. Because again, the dialogue.
There was a fight here, yes.
But as he's looking around, he spots...
You recognise the body.
Not to start with. Because to start with, he's just looking around in general, under things, you know, behind things, the ripped painting, because she'd ripped a painting there because she thought it was almost... torturing her after she killed him. And
he's painted this picture of this clown, isn't he? He's kind of like pointing out at the audience and laughing almost. Yeah.
And he spots a glove on the floor. Now he picks it up and is just about to turn around and say, look, Sarge, or whatever. And as he turns around, they've stepped back and the man's face is visible. And he recognizes that as the man Alice left with the previous night. And oh my God, that's hers. Because the plot point of her misplacing a glove had been in the bar earlier. They'd gone to a tea room, basically. And so he just puts it in his pocket and says nothing. And then we've got a guy outside, and I don't think I noticed him to start with. There's a guy outside, isn't there, who sort of saw... When Alice goes up the stairs with this guy, she's already disappearing up the stairs when the landlady comes to the door to say about a letter he'd had or a message for him. And she sees the other guy, but she doesn't see Alice. So, of course, when there's now a crime, nobody knows she was there except... the guy she was meant to be on a date with the previous night. And even that, he didn't know till he searches it.
No.
You see, now at first I thought it was him going to be doing the blackmailing, because
he's
the one that you could
pin it
to.
Yeah, he knows.
But then, and also, she did just treat him like shit.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of like, well, they got motive there
but
as well.
But he turns into devoted long-term boyfriend here.
Yeah.
After the way he's been treated, it makes that first scene even more of an outlier. And it does speak to inexperience that they almost can't think of an organic way to get her back to his apartment, so they just have her be a brat. And I just think, like, a modern film would probably have a better spin on that. Or maybe he'd upset her in some way, but not in a way that makes him a bad person, like a misunderstanding.
No, she goes from kind of being like really not sympathetic to actually, oh, she has to be a little bit sympathetic.
And she does become quite sympathetic, but we spend a bit more time around the sort of shop now. Frank goes in to use the phone, but he talks to her and she kind of says, she sees the glove and it's like she kind of admits she did it.
Yeah.
And then this guy Tracy arrives. And he was the one who'd seen her go up to the flat, and he has the other glove. Now, that wasn't clear on this viewing. I've only seen it once. It looked to me like he reached and found the glove in, what's he called, Frank's pocket.
Yeah, in the detective's pocket. Yeah, but I mean, he did find it, and then he kind of literally reaches into the detective's pocket and pulls out the glove. So.
Right, so he's got the other one. So he's been on the side. I was always a bit confused by that. But I didn't know.
Also, is it just to backtrack a little bit, it's a bit weird how Tracy is kind of introduced, because obviously... Crew takes her back to his flat, and it's literally just, we don't see Tracy to begin with. He only comes in later on through the film.
Yeah.
It's kind of just a voice like off screen saying, "Oh, you know, have you got a few bob? Can you help me out?" sort of thing.
Yeah.
Crew goes in and basically says, "No, f off," and then you never hear from him again. So it's kind of, it's really done a kind of really.
I thought I'd missed something.
Exactly. I thought, why is that included? And something is because it happens off screen as well. We don't kind of see him really to begin with. It's not until this scene that he sort of comes in.
And I think by now, I might have this wrong, but from memory, we're something like an hour into the film now. And it's only got 25 minutes to go. And
it takes a while.
We've not seen any blackmail.
No, for a film called Blackmail, the blackmail actually happens towards the end of the film. It's very strange.
So, yeah, that is all a bit odd. But so he comes into this store. He's a bit... I mean, it's fairly formal wear because it was a lot of shirt and ties and suits in that era and a hat. But he does look a bit dishevelled, this guy.
He's a bit run down, isn't he? He's not quite the same level as everybody else.
He didn't live very long. He died 11 years after this film was released. He's only 41 here, but he died at 52 of a heart attack. And I don't know if I know him from anything else. I'm just sort of having a look. He did have
no,
a...
No, we haven't covered them on this show. But if you listen to other Hitchcock podcasts, he'd have popped up in a few other previous Hitchcock films as well. I don't know where I've seen him elsewhere.
He was in not even the Alistair Sim one, the earlier version of Scrooge from 1935. He was Bob Cratchit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He was starred in that. Sir Seymour Hicks. Okay, I've never seen him.
Seymour Butts? No.
Seymour Butts. Sorry, that still makes me laugh. How pathetic is that?
Not as much as Amanda Hug and Kiss. That's the best.
Amanda Hug and Kiss.
I think that's got my favourite of all time. Why can't I get Amanda Hug and Kiss?
No, I've not seen anything he was in, but that sort of stands out as like, I know of that film, even though I've not seen that version. But yeah, he was in Juno and the Paycock the following year.
That was
year.
It, Juno and the Paycock, that was it.
But yeah, that anyway, he's suitably oily. And
I don't think I've seen any of his other films.
But the blackmail's pathetic. He basically gets a free cigar, some breakfast, a little bit of money, and that's it.
Yeah, considering he's after, you'd think in a man in his position would be after quite a lot of money, but no, as I say, he just wants a cigar. He wants the most expensive cigar in the shop, a free breakfast, which takes forever to eat, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's like he's
We
gonna sort of
say.
like fleece them for all they've got, really, doesn't it? It's like.
I
Yeah,
mean,
in the
this, yeah,
1920s
this was
way.
just the opening way, yeah, and it would have been some sort of protection money going forward, I'm sure. But
God, that's
at the
terrible.
same time, the landlady goes to the police, and
She's
she's
fabulous,
asked.
the landlady. She's great.
She's
I think
great in this
she's one of
scene.
my favourite characters.
She's great in this scene, and you would think she's been acting with sound all her life. She was pretty good as well,
I love
but
the part where
she's.
she puts on her pince-nez glasses to read the
Yeah.
letter.
She reads the letter, and it's to do with this Mr. Crewe anyway. And she said she saw him. They said, "How old?" And she said, "I don't know. He kept his hat on."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Do you have
Well,
no
they
idea
ask
if?"
him what did he look like. What did he look like? He said, "Well, he
But they
not
said,
blonde,
"How old was
neither
he?"
blonde nor brunette, because he's wearing a hat, as all men did back then."
But it's just fun. It's just funny. She said, "No, he kept his hat on, so I don't know how old he was." And I'm like,
What's
"So
that got to do with it?
you don't know if someone's 20 or 60 because they've got a hat
Because
on?"
they're wearing a hat. What?
Well, it's how you differentiate if someone's either young, they've got, sort of a hair colour. If they're old, they've got
Well,
grey hair.
exactly.
Well,
That's
yeah,
true.
but you could have a fair guess at this man's age. You'd overestimate, obviously, because people aged a bit more back then. But I would have said late 40s, and he's actually early 40s, but then this is a century ago, nearly.
I mean, well, look at Ivan Novello in The Lodger. Now, he was what, early 20s?
In the
And he was wearing a hat.
lodger, no, he's about 34.
Was he 30? That was it, 20s or 30? I can't remember
He
which.
was 30. He was a 34-year-old
Oh no,
college
it's in
student
Downhill
down
that
here.
he's a lot older than what he is.
Yeah,
Yeah, well,
but
he's also wearing a hat. So,
then so then
Oh,
they
the landlady was also in Downhill, apparently.
as what?
She was one of the ladies in the fashion show. Not obviously doing the fashion show,
I
but
was
she was
gonna
dressed
say,
as
who'd pay to see
she
that?
was dressing the mannequins,
Oh,
apparently.
look at her in that coat.
But
All right.
she shows that she's, you know, she has a big fur stole on, big fur coat, you know, so she tries to present herself as wealthier than perhaps what she actually is.
But she's full of personality, and she says, "Yes, I saw somebody." And they're like, "Right, get records out." And thankfully, this guy has a criminal record. She picks him out,
I think it's quite an interesting
and
look. I mean, I don't know too much about the history of the police or like the development of it, for example, but I think it's quite an interesting look about how policing may or may not have been done at the time.
I don't really know. I mean, my uncle was a policeman in the Metropolitan Police and the Hertfordshire Police, and I would imagine he would know some of the history, but I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I don't even know how controversial it would be that he was he basically perverts the course of justice for a period of time here. The policeman, I mean, Frank. I don't know if that's controversial or not, because there was somewhat more of a hierarchical society and a respect for authority back then. So I don't know. I would imagine it would be somewhat questionable that he did that. But the point
Probably.
is, he gets a he rings in, and he finds out that this guy's wanted for questioning. He's near the scene. He's got a criminal record, so he sends the policeman. And just tells him what's gonna. He sends for policeman and tells him this is what's gonna happen to you now. And suddenly he's completely. Oh, I'm sort of a bit of a joke. I'll give you your money back. Let's let
Yeah,
it get
when he
it
gets
go.
threatened with jail, he's like, oh, it's all right, we can work it out.
We've had 20 minutes, a free cigar, and a free breakfast. That was the blackmail in this film, right? He jumps out the window. He don't even open it. He just jumps through the window.
Yeah, literally, just like there's a bit of dialogue, and the next scene you see, like, you hear the window break, and he's running outside, and that becomes a thrilling foot chase, which
Well,
builds
I
to a
think it
climax at the
starts.
British
He gets out
Museum.
of a car at one point. I'm presuming that was a taxi. Again, I missed it. But when it's stopped by police, he jumps out, and as he walks down the road, there's a policeman coming the other way. So he diverts into the British Museum. So that was Great Russell Street, whatever it's called.
Yep, you can still go there today, folks.
Yeah, you can still go there today.
Really good,
And
highly recommend a
literally
visit.
around the corner was a hotel my company used to use quite a lot. And then there was another one on the sort of main road further out. But
Next time I go to London, I will take a photo.
so it just basically, I mean, it's not a bad foot chase. It's intercut with her thinking about it and starting to write a letter to sort of confess because she just can't deal with this and she knows
No,
him
she writes a
innocent.
letter saying, I can't bear the thought of somebody else being put away for something that I've done, or something like that.
Yeah. But he falls through a skylight. He ends up on the roof, and he's like, "It's not me. You need to." And just as he's sort of trying to say something, he falls through the domed roof, and that's it. He falls to his death. And the police now can just assume he was the murderer, but Alice doesn't know this, so she runs to see.
No, I think that's quite a bit of tension. Good bit of tension there, I think.
It's well done. The last bit of this film is very well done. As I say, the setup's none too impressive, and the characterization is all over the place. But this to me feels more Hitchcock than anything we've seen so far. This last sort of 5 or 10 minutes of the film. Would you say that, Becca?
Yeah, largely I would. It's just the kind of the sort of setup payoff, really. I mean, there's a good sort of rough with the smooth, but it just doesn't kind of gel well together for me, just generally, until the last portion of this film.
It's like three different films in one.
Yeah, but I mean, that's due to, like, you know, due to the medium, due to the technology, that's due to it being a sound film over here in the UK, certainly, you know, in Britain. A combination of factors.
It does hang together as a film. I mean, it's not incompetent or anything. It's just very new. But yeah, she goes in to talk to the police. The police is about to she's about to tell him. And as much as Frank tries to stop him, the policeman's going, "No, let her tell me." And as she's literally about to say it was him, the phone goes and it says, and he's got to take that call. So he says, "You deal with her." And then obviously he's told that the death's happened, and she says, "Look, it was self-defense. I was attacked." Because he didn't even know that all this time.
No.
And the last thing we see is the damaged painting, which is obviously there as evidence. And you can see she's still a little bit unsettled about it all.
Yeah, because you've got the portrait of the clown, and you've got the kind of their portrait that he did sort of did together, her really poor drawing.
Which she scrubbed her name out.
She scribbled her name out, yeah, definitely. So
I was really sure at first, because I thought, hang on, was that evidence that say that she... It was her.
Well, this is it. That's incriminating,
well,
isn't it?
Well, he did write her name on it, or she did. I can't remember which. And before she left, she painted it out.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought that was like kind of like a kind of thing.
No, but there is the fact that he knows, she knows, and I think there'll still be a degree of she's going to struggle to live with this. Mm. But that's it. That's it for the film. 85 minutes. They're still coming
in. Yeah, so it's all kind of wrapped up, and they all kind of laugh it off in the end and say, make a joke. Monday, women on the force, you know.
So they say to the, I guess it's the equivalent of the desk sergeant, although you don't see him behind a desk, but he's the one who welcomed her there when she got there. And they're talking, and he says, "So you know, you were going to tell us who did it, were you?" And she says, "Yes." And then he says, Then they start saying, "Oh, she'll be a policeman. She'll be in the police next." And
yeah, she'll be in the police force.
I'll
next.
"I'll be okay on the dole, won't I?" And they laugh.
Yeah,
like,
job, love.
Fuck this, and everything this guy says, which is all lame. They're laughing their asses off her.
But it probably was funny back then. Mm. Not anymore.
You had to be there.
There you go. You had to be there.
You had to be alive in 1929 to appreciate the joke.
That what a woman.
Women, know your limits. No.
Yes. I think we should return to the gold standard. Wasn't it that women know your limits scene? Yeah. Women
Again,
know your limits.
That's another Harry Enfield joke.
It's a Harry Enfield sketch set in like the 40s or something.
Wherever you are, smash your limits. Yeah. Don't, you know, reach for the sky.
Final thoughts from me. I think I've covered it all, really. I think it hangs together all right. I'm still seeing little bits of the filmmaker he becomes. But yeah, this feels like the first talkie. They don't know what to do with it. It's massively overscored, but it would be, because everything before this was all score. Dialogue sequences are intercut with sequences that clearly were shot without any attempt to do dialogue. There's one or two, I don't know if they're overdubbed or what, but there's people not looking at the camera, and I don't know if they had anything like ADR then at all.
No, so they put, as I say, with Annie Andre's dialogue.
I know how they did hers. How did they do the other ones?
They probably would have done it the same way, getting other actors in, because yeah, there probably wasn't such a thing as ADR perhaps back then.
But looking at the camera, I just assumed it was redubbed because they're not.
No, so if they're not looking at the camera,
rare
so that probably would have been
without lip movement. It's really
no,
odd.
That's it. So it would have been somebody else doing their dialogue, or Hitchcock, or another his assistant director shouting directions at them. So that's probably why they're looking a bit strange. As I did kind of go through it a little bit at the top of the show, but it was a bit hurried. So apologies for that. But that's kind of why, especially in these films, not just Hitchcock, but other films as well, towards the end of the 1920s. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've already said it, really. I mean, she's one of the most irritating characters you could ever wish to see until she suddenly becomes a moral, lovely family girl.
I mean, to be fair, Dave, I think she's more traumatised, is what she's like.
It could be. She's been sort of scared back into her shell, and that maybe that sort of thing does make you grow.
Because everything about her afterwards is just kind of like, it's just guilt.
But it is one extreme to the other, and whilst you can explain it, it plays very strange when you watch it. But anyway, I just you know, it hangs together okay. The story's not bad. The actual, if it was called anything else other than Blackmail, I'd probably be slightly better.
What would you call this film instead? Just
I don't know what I would call it, but. Guilt, yeah.
Guilt, yeah, probably.
Guilt
yeah.
isn't a because bad, you know.
That seems to be the main theme that circulates a lot of it. It's just
the blackmail kind of... is a tiny bit of the film, and it's rather half-hearted anyway. Sure we can think of films like that when we've been, you know, a great big build-up to like actually a tiny bit of something. There's lots of films when they're not paced properly. It's not terrible. I think I've enjoyed it the least of the three we've done so far. I think. I don't really remember what I said about Downhill now, but although that was a bit of a strange film in a lot of ways, it was...
I only did that really because it was another Ivan Novello, and I thought it was quite interesting.
It was tonally a little bit confused, but it was...
Yeah, just because obviously it was another pre-code film, and this one deals with quite a shocking subject matter. Likewise, Downhill deals with another shocking subject matter of like male prostitution.
Taxi dancers,
yeah. As they were known.
So they've all got their limitations because of when they were, how early they are in someone's career. I mean, we tend to think of it as like, I mean, we think Tarantino was, you know, the enfant terrible, but he was about 28 by the time he got anything out. So you know, this guy is making films in his mid 20s. So and it's a very developing art form. So I'm not disposed to be too harsh on it. I'm glad I've seen it. I don't know under what circumstances I would have seen these films otherwise. And not only that, it's incredible to think, you know, this guy was still making films with Cary Grant and so on later, and Paul Newman, and, you know, a completely different era. In a completely different environment, you know, a sort of... A foggy sort of post-World War One London is so different.
We've got DeLorean in next week's film, so, you know.
Yeah. So I'm really kind of glad we did them. I think this is probably the weakest of the three. A lot of that is the art form hasn't kept pace with the technology, if you know what I mean. The technology's leapt forward and they don't really know what to do with it. But glad I've seen it. That's it from me.
I think I got on this... out of the three the most. I think the main thing of, as I said before, is a lot, it's basically sort of focused on guilt, like that seems to be the main focus, particularly after the event. There's a lot of like they really do establish like what's going through her head. I always think of like Lady Macbeth, you know, she keeps seeing things. It's that kind of that kind of thing. And plus also the actual real climax is her going to the police station and she's trying to confess, but yet she still doesn't for whatever reason. So in a way it's kind of a tragedy, and you know, there's no real happy ending in this. It's just
Shakespearean tragedy.
Well, I'll go that far, but going
into theory now, folks, come on.
But
you remember when King Lear bummed a cigar off And then had a free breakfast. It was tragic.
Other than that, it's an art form in its infancy by a legendary filmmaker who is also in his infancy. So,
And just for anyone, the Hitchcock cameo in this one is when they leave work and they're on a bus or a train. I think it's a bus.
They're on the tube, aren't they? I think.
Oh, they're on the tube, actually. They are.
He's harassed by a little boy.
He's sort of sat beside them, sort of facing outwards, and they're facing in a different direction, and the kid's bothering him. But he has a hat on.
He's reading a book, and he's a little boy who leans over and...
It looks like Hitchcock as you know him because his hair's covered by a hat.
He's wearing a hat, so you don't know how old he is.
So you don't know how old he is.
No.
Actually, that I've just proved my theory is completely wrong there because I can't tell how old he is. He does look about 60 there.
Even though he was nearly 30.
Yeah. But there you go. He would have been, he would have turned 30 a couple of months after this film was released in this country. So, yeah. But you got on with it pretty well, Chris, by the sound of it.
There were remote pacing issues. There were like that whole beginning bit just felt like what watching who am I following? Didn't sort of seem to go anywhere. You could have just gone straight to them sitting in the gallery going, "What should we do today?" Oh, I don't know. I'm going to pitch. Oh no, I don't. And, oh yes, I do. Oh no, I don't. I've changed my mind again.
Make your bloody mind up, woman. I got annoyed at her indecision.
I don't know what the point of the tea room being really, really busy was. I don't know.
I think it was just kind of an excuse to them to sort of get away. But I do know that obviously the staff and other patrons, when they filmed that scene, they were all there kind of watching it being filmed. So they just kind of got shuffled in as kind of being extras, really. So if some of them did kind of look a bit extra shifty, it's because obviously they weren't actors and they just happened to be, you know, staff who worked there or other patrons, other customers at the time who just got lumped in with the other extras, which I think is quite interesting. So obviously just to fill some gaps. Similar to Hitchcock filling in the extra job with the lodger and his two roles that he had, so...
Yeah, but I think it's suddenly become it now that this one feels like a Hitchcock cameo because I don't know if there was one last week. I don't think there was. And in the lodger, they just needed a body there. His back
did,
is to the camera.
Yeah, I think that
here,
this
to me is a true Hitchcock cameo.
Yeah, obviously he didn't have a cameo in like all of his films. I think I read out a list last week which ones that he doesn't appear in. This one he does, and there's a couple more that we'll go through that he doesn't have them. But like especially from the next couple of films that we'll be covering. He does have a sort of a regular cameo, and then like the more complicated his films become, he had to get the cameo in quite early. But as we also go on, he does kind of get quite easier to spot because he often has like a musical instrument, or he'll have like, for example, his cameo in The Birds. He'll have his two psylliums with him as he comes out the shop, and things like that. For example, so he'll have something that obviously his silhouette is quite famous. I don't know how else to say it, but you know, he'll have something with him that kind of makes him more noticeable as well. But as time goes on, as this film gets more complex, his cameos do tend to be like right near the start, so as not to give too much distraction.
Yeah, they do. They're often in sort of like title sequence, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
So okay, I'd be happier if I knew more about this, though, Chris. Mind you like it already, so you probably know everything. Because knowledge is the key to love and enjoyment.
Yes, but you can always do with more knowledge.
I'd like to know her route around London. I really would. How she managed
to
walk.
So would I.
How she managed to walk for several hours to get
around
the corner.
Is she next door? Why does she live so far away?
His flat is
Why does London look so empty?
Yeah. I don't know. London looks like... Yeah, look, it's a bit 28 days later.
It is a little bit. I wonder if there's a through line, you know.
Fact us, Becca.
Factoid. So I've got quite a few facts, and Dave, you've also got a fact. So I'll go through quite a few facts because I've got a few on this film, and then Dave, I'll pass over to you for perhaps the final fact.
There is only one, and it's just something I said earlier in the chat. She was like, "Oh, I didn't know that."
I think it's quite interesting. So this is quite a very tenuous fact. Obviously, I'm a big Gerry Anderson fan. There's a Gerry Anderson connection with this film.
The acting's wooden.
Yes, they're all puppets. All right. Via the cinematographer Jack Cox. He was director of photography on 1954 film Devil Girl from Mars, which recently received a Blu-ray transfer from Studio Canal. So check it out; it's really good. Very schlocky, but very good. But in this film, Devil Girl from Mars, Anderson was actually the sound editor. Which is quite a very early role before he would go on to film, obviously, film AP Films and then work with Lou Grade and the rest is history. Jack Cox also worked on Hitchcock's other films, The Ring, Farmer's Wife, Champagne, Manxman, Judy and the Peacock, Murder! Exclamation mark, Skin Game, Rich and Strange, Number 17, culminating in The Lady Vanishes, which we'll do on the series. Fun fact number two, obviously, as we spoke about, Annie Andres famously had a strong Czech accent, so she was dubbed or over-recorded, I guess, for this film, or rather she mouthed her lines, which were spoken by another actress, Joan Barry, who also appeared in Rich and Strange, which we didn't cover in this show, off-screen. Okay, so we've spoken about other films that are about filmmaking. Another one, a good one to watch, is obviously Singing in the Rain, which is famously about the kind of the transition to sound. As well as Babylon, obviously another good film to watch, obviously The Jazz Singer from 1927, also Singing in the Rain famously, as it's about that transition from silent to talkies as well. Fun fact number three, we've spoken a lot about obviously this film being the first talkie, so I'll give you a fact about Sir Richard, who plays Crewe. He was an artist and musician in real life. He was from Australia, and he really painted that the portrait of the clown, and he performed the Miss Up to Date song in real time in the film as well. He kind of did it live in the film, if that makes sense. And my kind of final fact really is I just need to find the quote. Obviously, we've spoken a little bit about Annie Andre, how annoying her character is first off in the film. But obviously, she made a couple of films with Hitchcock. And obviously, she's another example of the Hitchcock blonde, for example. She's probably kind of quite a famous example of this. Stop saying example. And it's obviously a trope that would continue throughout all of his films. There's an interview with Hitchcock in 1931 on how he kind of chose his actresses, really. And he said, she must be fashioned to please women rather than men. The reason being that women form 3/4 of the average cinema audience. Therefore, no actress can be a good commercial proposition unless she pleases women. So I think that's really quite interesting as well, especially in relation to like male gaze, for example, which would come out, Laura Mulvey's famous theory in the 1970s, mid-1970s, which still holds a lot today and perhaps more so in the post-kind of Me Too era, perhaps. But I think that's quite interesting that she was a draw for female audience as well, not just for the men, for example. So I think that's quite interesting. So Dave, you had a fun fact?
Oh yeah, it's just the female lead off this film. About 5 or 6 years later, about 4 years later, married Max Schmeling. Max Schmeling was a German boxer, and he was the world heavyweight champion between 1930 and 1932. He won it. It was vacant when he won it, but he's probably most famous within boxing for handing Joe Louis his first defeat. He beat Joe Louis is normally one of those argued among the best. He was champion for 11 years, although some of that was the Second World War. He did get beaten in a rematch, but after he finished boxing, he became like an executive for Coca-Cola in Germany, introduced like vending machines for it over there, and lived to the age of 99, which is not the way most boxers' lives end up. But yeah, he stayed in good health. He resented any attempt to sort of bring him into sort of Nazi propaganda, as did she. And he was widowed in 1987. He lived until 2005. But yes, she was about to marry the world heavyweight champion, or the former champion by then. And all the same era as, if you've seen the film Cinderella Man, that's not about him specifically, but it's that era, like Max Baer and fighters like that. And I forget which one the Cinderella Man was now. Which one was Cinderella Man? Hang on, I've got to think of the character's name. It's a Russell Crowe film.
It's Russell Crowe, yeah.
Cinderella Man was about, I should know this, this is embarrassing, I've forgotten this.
That's what I've embarrassed myself.
Oh, it's James J. Braddock, that was it. So it's all that sort of era. And I'm trying to think who won it from. Yeah, he won it after him. He won it from Max Baer. Max Baer was the one who, when he had his fatal heart attack, he was in a hotel and they said, would you like the house doctor? And he said, I'd rather have a people doctor. And that is right up there in like stupidest final words. But there you go. So that's it for me.
I want to go out saying a really crap joke.
Yeah, you don't want to go out saying that's what she said or something.
That's what she. Yeah, just said.
Ooh, pardon.
Yeah. Oh, that's what's that word? I still think of knowing me, knowing you all every time I hear. Ooh, pardon. The Christmas Alan Partridge Show with the sort of drag artist TV chef in it. Fanny something or other. But anyway, what was I going to say? The other thing is the script writer for this, or the guy who wrote, yeah, the guy.
Played
who,
by the actor Kevin Eldon, of course.
Sorry. Kevin Eldon, yeah. Who most of you will have seen in Hot Fuzz, for example.
Yes.
But Blackmail was based on a play, and I'm just looking that play up because I've got to remind myself of the name. So the play was of the same name, but it was by a guy called Charles Bennett. And Charles Bennett went on to be a screenwriter for Hitchcock. We are coming to entries that he wrote.
We are, definitely.
So that's
kind of like, there's a lot of kind of repeat offenders, aren't there? Kind of, you know, worked with the cinematographer quite a long time. Like unbeknownst to him, obviously Michael Powell, they were contemporaries as well, and he kind of had a few inputs. Like, for example, he reportedly influenced, you know, it was his idea for them to culminate at the British Museum and to do that kind of big climax there. So that was kind of his idea, which is quite interesting, I think. You know, that's sort of similar. Again, that if we go through this series as well, there'll be other sort of collaborators, regular names that pop up time and time again. Also, I should have done this at the top of the show, but I'd like to give a shout out to Matt Brooker. Hello, Matt. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're enjoying the show so far. We got in touch via his brother Pete, who did like quite a funny impression of myself going, oh,
well, no,
yes, there's an impression of me, an impression of Dave, an impression of Homer Simpson.
It's an impression of me doing an impression of you.
Did an impression of Homer.
Yeah.
Going, I believe you have a package for me. Yes, sir. What's your first name? I don't know.
Yeah, and it's because I pointed out every time you said, I don't know, it sounded a bit like that.
I don't know. So that's it. But yeah, just say, hi, Matt. That's a great impression. Thank you very much. Do get in touch with us on the socials. Love to hear from you. So yeah, hi, Matt. And thanks for your video clip. Really appreciate it.
As for that social media, you can find me at ThePastKid1976 on Twitter.
You can find me at Cinematronics. You can also find all the old episodes on Podbean. If you just search for Do You Expect Us to Talk, you can find it all on there.
You can find us on Facebook, Do You Expect Us to Talk, on Twitter, X, at The Expect Us to Talk, on YouTube, Do You Expect Us to Talk. As Chris said, we're on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Podbay, obviously Google, and Stitcher have now shut down. But whatever platform you're on, you can support us generally in three ways. You can listen to us, thank you very much. You can subscribe. And also support us.
Stop asking them to support us in three ways.
Sorry.
We're not offering that at any support level.
There are three different methods by which you can support us. One is by listening.
You can support us via three methods.
By
there you go. Not support
and the other
us
is by giving a five-star
ways.
Review on whichever platform you're listening to us on. So those are the three modes of support.
And rather don't than three ways. Fucking two other people.
I'm going to write it. This is me typing three methods. There we go. I made a typo. So you can listen to us. Thank you very much. Subscribe to us on whichever platform you are, and leaving us a hopefully glowing five-star review, as wherever you are, it will help us to rank higher and attract more listeners. And perhaps, you know, if you're on whatever social media platform you're on, update your status. Say, oh, just listen to the latest episode of Do You Expect Us to Talk? Just link us out and then share us on your feed, and hopefully that can attract more listeners that way.
And I also want to shout out and give our love to Charlie, just because we haven't mentioned him for a while.
Yes, Charlie is a legend.
So I genuinely don't know the answer to this next bit. I've got a fair idea, but I'm not certain what is happening next, Becca.
So next, Do You Expect Us Talk will return with celebrating its 90th anniversary, the original 1934 film of The Man Who Knew Too Much.